us. He showed no fear, no discomfort. In everything he did, the stranger's movements were gentle and slow, and he was not stung, nor did he crush or hurt a single bee. This impressed old Gow. He had assumed that barbarians were inscrutable, unreadable, mysterious creatures, but this man seemed overjoyed to have encountered Gow's bees. His eyes were shining. Old Gow fired up the brazier to boil some water. Long before the charcoal was hot, however, the stranger had removed from his bag a contraption of glass and metal. He had filled the upper half of it with water from the stream, lit a flame, and soon a kettleful of water was steaming and bubbling. Then the stranger took two tin mugs from his bag and some green tea leaves wrapped in paper and dropped the leaves into the mug and poured on the water. It was the finest tea that old Gow had ever drunk, better by far than his cousin's tea. They drank it cross-legged on the floor. "I would like to stay here for the summer, in this house," said the stranger. "Here? This is not even a house," said old Gow. "Stay down in the village. Widow Chung has a room." "I will stay here," said the stranger. "Also, I would like to rent one of your beehives." Old Gow had not laughed in years. There were those in the village who would have thought such a thing impossible, but still he laughed then, a guffaw of surprise and amusement that seemed to have been jerked out of him. "I am serious," said the stranger. He placed 4 silver coins on the ground between them. Old Gow had not seen where he got them from. 3 silver Mexican pesos, a coin that had become popular in China years before, and a large silver yuan. It was as much money as old Gow might see in a year of selling honey. "For this money," said the stranger, "I would like someone to bring me food. Every 3 days should suffice." Old Gow said nothing. He finished his tea and stood up. He pushed through the oiled cloth to the clearing high on the hillside. He walked over to the 11 hives. Each consisted of 2 brood boxes with 1, 2, 3, or in one case even 4 boxes above that. He took the stranger to the hive with 4 boxes above it, each box filled with frames of comb. "This hive is yours," he said. They were plant extracts. That was obvious. They worked, in their way, for a limited time, but they were also extremely poisonous. But watching poor Professor Presbrey during those final days, his skin, his eyes, his gait, had convinced me that he had not been on entirely the wrong path. "I took his case of seeds, of pods, of roots, and of dried extracts, and I thought. I pondered. I cogitated. I reflected. It was an intellectual problem and could be solved, as my old maths tutor had always sought to demonstrate to me, by intellect. They were plant extracts, and they were lethal. Methods I used to render them non-lethal rendered them quite ineffective. It was not a 3-pipe problem. I suspect it was something approaching a 300-pipe problem before I hit upon an initial idea, a notion, perhaps, of a way of processing the plants that might allow them to be ingested by human beings. It was not a line of investigation that could easily be followed in Baker Street. So it was, in the autumn of 1903, that I moved to Sussex and spent the winter reading every book and pamphlet and monograph so far published, I fancy, upon the care and keeping of bees. And so it was that in early April of 1904, armed only with theoretical knowledge, I took delivery from a local farmer of my first package of bees. I wonder sometimes that Watson did not suspect anything. Then again, Watson's glorious obtuseness has never ceased to surprise me. And sometimes, indeed, I had relied upon it. Still, he knew what I was like when I had no work to occupy my mind, no case to solve. He knew my lassitude, my black moods, when I had no case to occupy me. So how could he believe that I had truly retired? He knew my methods. Indeed, Watson was there when I took receipt of my first bees. He watched, from a safe distance, as I poured the bees from the package into the empty waiting hive like slow, gently humming treacle. He saw my excitement, and he saw nothing. And the years passed, and we watched the empire crumble. We watched the government unable to govern. We watched those poor heroic boys sent to the trenches of Flanders to die. All these things confirmed me in my opinions. I was not doing the right thing. I was doing the only thing. As my face grew unfamiliar, and my finger joints swelled and ached, not so much as they might have done, though, which I attributed to the many bee stings I had received in my first few years as an investigative apiarist. And as Watson, dear, brave, obtuse Watson, faded with time and paled and shrank, his skin becoming greyer, his moustache becoming the same shade of grey as his skin, my resolve to conclude my researches did not diminish. If anything, it increased. So, my initial hypotheses were tested upon the South Downs, in an apiary of my own devising, each hive modelled upon Langstroth's. I do believe that I made every mistake that ever a novice beekeeper could or has ever made, and in addition, due to my investigations, an entire hive full of mistakes that no beekeeper has ever made before, or shall, I trust, ever make again. The case of the poisoned beehive, Watson might have called many of them, although the mystery of the transfixed Women's Institute would have drawn more attention to my researches, had anyone been interested enough to investigate. As it was, I chided Mrs. Telford for simply taking a jar of honey from the shelves here without consulting me, and I ensured that, in the future, she was given several jars for her cooking from the more regular hives, and that honey from the experimental hives was locked away once it had been collected. I do not believe that this ever drew comment. I experimented with Dutch bees, with German bees, and with Italians, with Carniolans and Caucasians. I regretted the loss of our British bees to blight, and even where they had survived, to interbreeding, although I found and worked with a small hive I purchased and grew up from a frame of brood and a queen cell from an old abbey in St. Albans, which seemed to me to be original British breeding stock. I experimented for the best part of 2 decades before I concluded that the bees that I sought, if they existed, were not to be found in England, and would not survive the distances they would need to travel to reach me by international parcel post. I needed to examine bees in India. I needed to travel perhaps further afield than that. I have a smattering of languages. I had my flower seeds and my extracts and tinctures in syrup. I needed nothing more. I packed them up, arranged for the cottage on the downs to be cleaned and aired once a week, and for Master Wilkins, to whom I am afraid I had developed the habit of referring to his obvious distress as Young Villikins, to inspect the beehives, and to harvest and sell surplus honey in Eastbourne Market, and to prepare the hives for winter. I told them I did not know when I should be back. I am an old man. Perhaps they did not expect me to return. And if this was indeed the case, they would, strictly speaking, have been right. Old Gow was impressed, despite himself. He had lived his life among bees, still watching the stranger shake the bees from the boxes with a practiced flick of his wrist, so cleanly and so sharply that the black bees seemed more surprised than angered, and simply flew or crawled back into their hive, was remarkable. The stranger then stacked the boxes filled with comb on top of one of the weaker hives, so old Gow would still have the honey from the hive the stranger was renting. So it was that old Gow gained a lodger. Old Gow gave the Widow Chung's granddaughter a few coins to take the stranger food 3 times a week, mostly rice and vegetables, along with an earthenware pot filled, when she left at least, with boiling soup. Every 10 days old Gow would walk up the hill himself. He went initially to check on the hives, but soon discovered that under the stranger's care all 11 hives were thriving as they had never thrived before. And indeed, there was now a 12th hive, from a captured swarm of the black bees the stranger had encountered while on a walk along the hill. Old Gal brought wood the next time he came up to the shack, and he and the stranger spent several afternoons wordlessly working together, making extra boxes to go onto the hives, building frames to fill the boxes. One evening, the stranger told Old Gal that the frames they were making had been invented by an American only 70 years before. This seemed like nonsense to Old Gal, who made frames as his father had, and as they did across the valley, and as, he was certain, his grandfather and his grandfather's grandfather had. But he said nothing. He enjoyed the stranger's company. They made hives together, and Old Gal wished that the stranger was a younger man. Then he would stay there for a long time, and Old Gal would have someone to leave his beehives to when he died. But there were two old men nailing boxes together with thin, frosty hair and old faces, and neither of them would see another dozen winters. Old Gal noticed that the stranger had planted a small, neat garden beside the hive that he had claimed as his own, which he had moved away from the rest of the hives. He had covered it with a net. He had also created a back door to the hive, so that the only bees that could reach the plants came from the hive that he was renting. Old Gal also observed that, beneath the netting, there were several trays filled with what appeared to be sugar solution of some kind, one colored bright red, one green, one a startling blue, one yellow. He pointed to them, but all the stranger did was nod and smile. The bees were lapping up the syrups, though, clustering and crowding on the sides of the tin dishes with their tongues down, eating until they could eat no more, and then returning to the hive. The stranger had made sketches of Old Gal's bees. He showed the sketches to Old Gal, tried to explain the ways that Old Gal's bees differed from other honeybees, talked of ancient bees preserved in stone for millions of years, but here the stranger's Chinese failed him. And truthfully, Old Gal was not interested. They were his bees until he died, and after that they were the bees of the mountainside. He had brought other bees here, but they had sickened and died, or been killed in raids by the black bees, who took their honey and left them to starve. The last of these visits was in late summer. Old Gal went down the mountainside. He did not see the stranger again. It is done. It works. Already I feel a strange combination of triumph and of disappointment, as if of defeat, or of distant storm clouds teasing at my senses. It is strange to look at my hands and to see not my hands as I know them, but the hands I remember from my younger days, knuckles unswollen, dark hairs not snow white on the backs. It was a quest that had defeated so many. A problem with no apparent solution. The first emperor of China died and nearly destroyed his empire in pursuit of it 3,000 years ago, and all it took me was, what, 20 years? I do not know if I did the right thing or not, although any retirement without such an occupation would have been literally maddening. I took the commission from Mycroft. I investigated the problem. I arrived inevitably at the solution. Will I tell the world? I will not. And yet I have half a pot of dark brown honey remaining in my bag, half a pot of honey that is worth more than nations. I was tempted to write, worth more than all the tea in China, perhaps because of my current situation, but fear that even Watson would deride it as cliché. And speaking of Watson, there is one thing left to do. My only remaining goal, and it is small enough. I shall make my way to Shanghai, and from there I shall take ship to Southampton, a half a world away. And once I am there, I shall seek out Watson, if he still lives. And I fancy he does. It is irrational, I acknowledge, and yet I am certain that I would know, somehow, had Watson passed beyond the veil. I shall buy theatrical makeup, disguise myself as an old man so as not to startle him, and I shall invite my old friend over for tea. There will be honey on buttered toast served with the tea that afternoon, I fancy. There were tales of a barbarian who passed through the village on his way east, but the people who told old Gow this did not believe that it could have been the same man who had lived in Gow's shack. This one was young and proud, and his hair was dark. It was not the old man who had walked through those parts in the spring, although, one person told Gow, the bag was similar. Old Gow walked up the mountainside to investigate, although he suspected what he would find before he got there. The stranger was gone, and the stranger's bag. There had been much burning, though. That was clear. Papers had been burnt. Old Gow recognized the edge of a drawing the stranger had made of one of his bees, but the rest of the papers were ash or blackened beyond recognition. Even had old Gow been able to read barbarian writing. The papers were not the only things to have been burnt. Parts of the hive that stranger had rented were now only twisted ash. There were blackened, twisted strips of tin that might once have contained brightly colored syrups. The color was added to the syrups, the stranger had told him once, so that he could tell them apart, although for what purpose old Gow had never inquired. He examined the shack like a detective, searching for a clue as to the stranger's nature or his whereabouts. On the ceramic pillow, 4 silver coins had been left for him to find, 2 yuan coins and 2 silver pesos, and he put them away. Behind the shack, he found a heap of used slurry, with the last bees of the day still crawling upon it, tasting whatever sweetness was still on the surface of the still sticky wax. Old Gow thought long and hard before he gathered up the slurry, wrapped it loosely in cloth, and put it in a pot, which he filled with water. He heated the water on the brazier, but did not let it boil. Soon enough, the wax floated to the surface, leaving the dead bees and the dirt and the pollen and the propolis inside the cloth. He let it cool. Then he walked outside and he stared up at the moon. It was almost full. He wondered how many villagers knew that his son had died as a baby. He remembered his wife, but her face was distant, and he had no portraits or photographs of her. He thought that there was nothing he was so suited for on the face of the earth as to keep the black bullet-like bees on the side of this high, high hill. There was no other man who knew their temperament as he did. The water had cooled. He lifted the now solid block of beeswax out of the water, placed it on the boards of the bed to finish cooling. Then he took the cloth filled with dirt and impurities out of the pot. And then, because he too was, in his way, a detective, and once you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however unlikely, must be the truth, he drank the sweet water in the pot. There is a lot of honey and slurry, after all, even after the majority of it has dripped through a cloth and been purified. The water tasted of honey, but not a honey that Gow had ever tasted before. It tasted of smoke and metal and strange flowers and odd perfumes. It tasted, Gow thought, a little like sex. He drank it all down, and then he slept, with his head on the ceramic pillow. When he woke, he thought, he would decide how to deal with his cousin, who would expect to inherit the 12 hives on the hill when old Gow went missing. He would be an illegitimate son, perhaps, the young man who would return in the days to come. Or perhaps a son, young Gow, who would remember now. It did not matter. He would go to the city, and then he would return, and he would keep the black bees on the side of the mountain for as long as days and circumstances would allow. The Man Who Forgot Ray Bradbury. I am forgetting things, which scares me. I am losing words, although I am not losing concepts. I hope that I am not losing concepts. If I am losing concepts, I am not aware of it. If I am losing concepts, how would I know? Which is funny, because my memory was always so good. Everything was in there. Sometimes my memory was so good that I even thought that I could remember things I didn't know yet, remembering forward. I don't think there's a word for that, is there? Remembering things that haven't happened yet. I don't have that feeling I get when I go looking in my head for a word that isn't there, as if someone must have come and taken it in the night. When I was a young man, I lived in a big shared house. I was a student then. We had our own shelves in the kitchen, neatly marked with our names, and our own shelves in the fridge, upon which we kept our own eggs, cheese, yogurt, milk. I was always punctilious about using only my own provisions. Others were not so... There. I lost a word. One that would mean careful to obey the rules. The other people in the house were... not so. I would go to the fridge, but my eggs would have vanished. I am thinking of a sky filled with spaceships, so many of them that they seem like a plague of locusts, silver against the luminous mauve of the night. Things would go missing from my room back then as well. Boots! I remember my boots going, or being gone, I should say, as I did not ever actually catch them in the act of leaving. Boots do not just go. Somebody went them. Just like my big dictionary. Same house, same time period. I went to the small bookshelf beside my bed. Everything was by my bed. It was my room, but it was not much larger than a cupboard with a bed in it. I went to the shelf, and the dictionary was gone. Just a dictionary-sized hole in my shelf to show where my dictionary wasn't. All the words and the book they came in were gone. Over the next month, they also took my radio, a can of shaving foam, a pad of notepaper, and a box of pencils. And my yogurt. And, I discovered during a power cut, my candles. Now I am thinking of a boy with new tennis shoes who believes he can run forever. No, that is not giving it to me. A dry town in which it rained forever. A road through the desert on which good people see a mirage. A dinosaur that is a movie producer. The mirage was the pleasure dome of Kublai Khan. No. Sometimes, when the words go away, I can find them by creeping up on them from another direction. Say I go and look for a word, I'm discussing the inhabitants of the planet Mars, say, and I realize that the word for them has gone. I might also realize that the missing word occurs in a sentence or title, the Chronicles. My favorite, If that does not give it to me, I circle the idea. Little green men, I think, or tall, dark-skinned, gentle, dark they were and golden-eyed. And suddenly the word Martians is waiting for me, like a friend or a lover at the end of a long day. I left that house when my radio went. It was too wearing. The slow disappearance of the things I had thought so safely mine, item by item, thing by thing, object by object, word by word. When I was 12, I was told a story by an old man that I have never forgotten. A poor man found himself in a forest as night fell, and he had no prayer book to say his evening prayers. So he said, "God who knows all things, I have no prayer book. And I do not know any prayers by heart, but you know all the prayers. You are God. So this is what I am going to do. I am going to say the alphabet, and I will let you put the words together." There are things missing from my mind, and it scares me. Icarus! It's not as if I have forgotten all names. I remember Icarus. He flew too close to the sun. In the stories, though, it's worth it. Always worth it to have tried, even if you fail, even if you fall like a meteor forever. Better to have flamed in the darkness, to have inspired others, to have lived, than to have sat in the darkness cursing the people who borrowed, but did not return your candle. I have lost people, though. It's strange when it happens. I don't actually lose them, not in the way one loses one's parents, either as a small child when you think you are holding your mother's hand in a crowd, and then you look up and it's not your mother, or later, when you have to find the words to describe them at a funeral service or a memorial, or when you are scattering ashes on a garden of flowers or into the sea. I sometimes imagine I would like my ashes to be scattered in a library. But then the librarians would just have to come in early the next morning to sweep them up again before the people got there. I would like my ashes scattered in a library or possibly a fun fair. A 1930s fun fair where you ride carousel? Roller coaster? The thing you ride and you become young again. The Ferris wheel. Yes. There is another carnival that comes to town as well, bringing evil by the pricking of my thumbs. Shakespeare. I remember Shakespeare, and I remember his name and who he was and what he wrote. He's safe for now. Perhaps there are people who forget Shakespeare. They would have to talk about the man who wrote To Be or Not To Be, not the film, starring Jack Benny, whose real name was Benjamin Kabelski, who was raised in Waukegan, Illinois, an hour or so outside Chicago. Waukegan, Illinois, was later immortalized as Greentown, Illinois, in a series of stories and books by an American author who left Waukegan and went to live in Los Angeles. I mean, of course, the man I am thinking of. I can see him in my head when I close my eyes. I used to look at his photographs on the back of his books. He looked mild, and he looked wise, and he looked kind. He wrote a story about Poe to stop Poe being forgotten, about a future where they burn books and they forget them. And in the story, we are on Mars, although we might as well be in Waukegan or Los Angeles, as critics, as those who would repress or forget books, as those who would take the words, all the words, dictionaries and radios full of words, as those people are walked through a house and murdered one by one by orangutan, by pit and pendulum. For the love of God, Montressa! Poe. I know Poe. And Montressa. And Benjamin Kabelski, and his wife, Sadie Marks, who was no relation to the Marx brothers, and who performed as Mary Livingston. All these names in my head. I was 12. I had read the books, I had seen the film, and the burning point of paper was the moment where I knew that I would have to remember this, because people would have to remember books if other people burn them or forget them. We will commit them to memory. We will become them. We become authors. We become their books. I'm sorry. I lost something there. Like a path I was walking that dead-ended, and now I am alone and lost in the forest, and I am here, and I do not know where here is anymore. You must learn a Shakespeare play. I will think of you as Titus Andronicus. Or you, whoever you are, you could learn an Agatha Christie novel. You will be murder on the Orient Express. Someone else can learn the poems of John Wilmot, Earl of Rochester. And you, whoever you are, listening to this, can learn a Dickens book, and when I want to know what happened to Barnaby Rudge, I will come to you. You can tell me. And the people who would burn the words, the people who would take the books from the shelves, the firemen and the ignorant, the ones afraid of tales and words and dreams and Halloween, and people who have tattooed themselves with stories, and boys, you can grow mushrooms in your cellar, and as long as your words, which are people, which are days, which are my life, as long as your words survive, then you lived and you mattered and you changed the world, and I cannot remember your name. I learned your books. Burned them into my mind, in case the firemen come to town. But who you are is gone. I wait for it to return to me, just as I waited for my dictionary or for my radio or for my boots, and with as meager a result. All I have left is the space in my mind where you used to be, and I am not so certain about even that. I was talking to a friend, and I said, "Are these stories familiar to you?" I told him all the words I knew, the ones about the monsters coming home to the house with the human child in it, the ones about the lightning salesman and the wicked carnival that followed him, and the Martians and their fallen glass cities and their perfect canals. I told him all the words, and he said he hadn't heard of them, that they didn't exist. And I worry I was keeping them alive, like the people in the snow at the end of the story, walking backwards and forwards, remembering, repeating the words of the stories, making them real. I think it's God's fault. I mean, he can't be expected to remember everything. God can't. Busy chap. So perhaps he delegates things. Sometimes just goes, "You, I want you to remember the dates of the Hundred Years' War. And you remember Okapi. You, remember Jack Benny, who was Benjamin Kubelski from Waukegan, Illinois." And then, when you forget the things that God has charged you with remembering, bam! No more Okapi, just an Okapi-shaped hole in the world, which is halfway between an antelope and a giraffe. No more Jack Benny, no more Waukegan, just a hole in your mind where a person or a concept used to be. I don't know. I don't know where to look. Have I lost an author, just as once I lost a dictionary? Or worse, did God give me this one small task, and now I have failed him, and because I have forgotten him, he has gone from the shelves, gone from the reference works, and now he only exists in our dreams. My dreams. I do not know your dreams. Perhaps you do not dream of a veldt that is only wallpaper, but that eats two children. Perhaps you do not know that Mars is heaven, where our beloved dead go to wait for us and consume us in the night. You do not dream of a man arrested for the crime of being a pedestrian. I dream these things. If he existed, then I have lost him. Lost his name. Lost his book titles one by one by one. Lost the stories. And I fear that I am going mad. For I cannot just be growing old. If I have failed in this one task, oh God, then only let me do this thing that you may give the stories back to the world, because perhaps, if this works, they will remember him. All of them will remember him. His name will once more become synonymous with small American towns at Halloween when the leaves skitter across the sidewalk like frightened birds, or with Mars, or with love. And my name will be forgotten. I am willing to pay that price, if the empty space in the bookshelf of my mind can be filled again before I go. Dear God, hear my prayer. A. B. C. D. E. F. G. Jerusalem. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. William Blake. Jerusalem, thought Morrison, was like a deep pool where time had settled too thickly. It had engulfed him, engulfed both of them, and he could feel the pressure of time pushing him up and out, like swimming down too deep. He was glad to be out of it. Tomorrow he would go back to work once more. Work was good, it would give him something to focus on. He turned on the radio and then, mid-song, turned it off. "I was enjoying that," said Dolores. She was cleaning the fridge before filling it with fresh food. He said, "I'm sorry." He couldn't think straight, with the music playing. He needed the silence. Morrison closed his eyes, and for a moment he was back in Jerusalem, feeling the desert heat on his face, staring at the old city and understanding for the first time how small it all was, that the real Jerusalem, 2,000 years ago, was smaller than an English country town. Their guide, a lean, leathery woman in her 50s, pointed. "That's where the Sermon on the Mount would have been given? That's where Jesus was arrested. He was imprisoned there, tried before Pilate there, at the far end of the temple, crucified on that hill. She pointed matter-of-factly down the slopes and up again. It was a few hours' walk at most. Dolores took photos. She and their guide had hit it off immediately. Morrison had not wanted to visit Jerusalem. He had wanted to go to Greece for his holidays, but Dolores had insisted. Jerusalem was biblical, she told him. It was part of history. They walked through the old town, starting in the Jewish quarter. Stone steps, closed shops, cheap souvenirs. A man walked past them wearing a huge black fur hat and a thick coat. Morrison winced. He must be boiling. It's what they used to wear in Russia, said the guide. They wear it here. The fur hats are for holidays. Some of them wear hats even bigger than that. Dolores put a cup of tea down in front of him. Penny for your thoughts, she said. Remembering the holiday. You don't want to brood on it, she said. Best to let it go. Why don't you take the dog for a nice walk? He drank the tea. The dog looked at him expectantly when he went to put the lead on it, as if it were about to say something. Come on, boy, said Morrison. He went left, down the avenue, heading for the heath. It was green. Jerusalem had been golden, a city of sand and rock. They walked from the Jewish quarter to the Muslim quarter, passing bustling shops piled high with sweet things to eat, with fruits or with bright clothes. Then the sheets are gone, their guide had said to Dolores. Jerusalem syndrome. Never heard of it, she said. Then to Morrison, have you ever heard of it? I was miles away, said Morrison. What does that mean, that door with all the stencils on it? It welcomes someone back from a pilgrimage to Mecca. There you go, said Dolores. For us, it was going to Jerusalem. Someone else goes somewhere else. Even in the Holy Land, they're still pilgrims. Nobody comes to London, said Morrison. Not for that. Dolores ignored him. So they're gone, she said to the guide. The wife comes back from a shopping trip or the museum, and there's the sheets gone. Exactly, said the guide. She goes to the front desk and tells them she does not know where the husband is. Dolores put her hand around Morrison's arm, as if assuring herself that he was there. And where is he? He has Jerusalem syndrome. He is on the street corner, wearing nothing but a toga, that's the sheets. He is preaching, normally about being good, obeying God, loving each other. Come to Jerusalem and go mad, said Morrison. Not much of an advertising slogan. Their guide looked at him sternly. It is, she said, with what Morrison thought might actually be pride, the only location-specific mental illness. And it is the only easily curable mental illness. You know what the cure is? Take away their sheets. The guide hesitated. Then she smiled. Close. You take the person out of Jerusalem. They get better immediately. Afternoon, said the man at the end of his road. They'd been nodding to each other for 11 years now, and he still had no idea of the man's name. Bit of a tan. Been on holiday, have we? Jerusalem, said Morrison. Brr, wouldn't catch me going there. Get blown up or kidnapped soon as look at you. That didn't happen to us, said Morrison. Still, safer at home, eh? Morrison hesitated. Then he said, in a rush, We went through a youth hostel, down to an underground, he lost the word, water storage place from Herod's time. They stored the rainwater underground so it wouldn't evaporate. 100 years ago, someone rowed a boat all the way through underground Jerusalem. The lost word hovered at the edge of his consciousness like a hole in a dictionary. 2 syllables, begins with a C, means deep echoing underground place where they store water.
Well then, said his neighbor.
Right, said Morrison. The heath was green, and it rolled in gentle slopes interrupted by oak and beech, by chestnut and poplar. He imagined a world in which London was divided, in which London was a city crusaded against, lost and won and lost again, over and over. Perhaps, he thought, It isn't madness. Perhaps the cracks are just deeper there, or the sky is thin enough that you can hear when God talks to his prophets. But nobody stops to listen any longer. "Cistern," he said aloud. The green of the heath became dry and golden, and the heat burned his skin like the opening of an oven door. It was as if he had never left. "My feet hurt," Dolores was saying. And then she said, "I'm going back to the hotel." Their guide looked concerned. "I just want to put my feet up for a bit," said Dolores. "It's just all so much to take in." They were passing the Christ prison shop. It sold souvenirs and carpets. "I'll bathe my feet. You two carry on without me. Pick me up after lunch." Morrison would have argued, but they had hired the guide for the whole day. Her skin was dark and weathered. She had an extraordinarily white smile when she smiled. She led him to a cafe. "So," said Morrison, "business good?" "We do not see as many tourists," she said, "not since the Intifada began." "Dolores, my wife, she's always wanted to come here, see the holy sites." "We have so many of them here. Whatever you believe, Christian or Muslim or Jew, it's still the holy city. I've lived here all my life." "I suppose you must be looking forward to them sorting all this out," he said. "The Palestinian situation. The politics." She shrugged. "It doesn't matter to Jerusalem," she said. "The people come. The people believe. Then they kill each other to prove that God loves them." "Well," he said, "how would you fix it?" She smiled her whitest smile. "Sometimes," she said, "I think it would be best if it was bombed. If it was bombed back to a radioactive desert. Then who would want it? But then I think they would come here and collect the radioactive dust that might contain atoms of the dome of the rock, or of the temple, or a wall that Christ leaned against on his way to the cross. People would fight over who owns a poisonous desert, if that desert was Jerusalem." "You don't like it here." "You should be glad there is no Jerusalem where you come from. Nobody wants to partition London. Nobody goes on pilgrimages to the holy city of Liverpool. No prophets walked in Birmingham. Your country is too young. It is still green."
"England's not young."
"Here, they still struggle over decisions made 2,000 years ago. They've been fighting about who owns this city for over 3,000 years when King David took it in battle from the Jebusites." He was drowning in the time, could feel it crushing him like an ancient forest being crushed into oil. She said, "Do you have any children?" The question took Morrison by surprise. "We wanted kids. It didn't work out that way." "Is she looking for a miracle, your wife?" "They do, sometimes." "She has faith," he said. "I've never believed. But no, I don't think so." He sipped his coffee. "So, are you married?"
"I lost my husband."
"Was it a bomb?"
"What?"
"How you lost your husband."
"An American tourist from Seattle."
"Oh." They finished their coffee.
"Shall we see how your wife's feet are doing?"
As they walked up the narrow street towards the hotel, Morrison said, "I'm really lonely. I work at a job I don't enjoy and come home to a wife who loves me but doesn't much like me. And some days it feels like I can't move and that all I want is for the whole world to go away." She nodded.
"Yes, but you don't live in Jerusalem."
The guide waited in the lobby of the hotel while Morrison went up to his room. He was, somehow, not surprised in the least to see that Dolores was not in the bedroom or in the tiny bathroom, and that the sheets that had been on the bed that morning were now gone. His dog could have walked the heath forever, but Morrison was getting tired, and a fine rain was drizzling. He walked back through a green world, a green and pleasant world, he thought, knowing that wasn't quite it. His head was like a filing cabinet that had fallen downstairs, and all the information in it was jumbled and disordered. They caught up with his wife on the Via Dolorosa. She wore a sheet, yes, but she seemed intent, not mad. She was calm, frighteningly so. "Everything is love," she was telling the people. "Everything is Jerusalem. God is love. Jerusalem is love." A tourist took a photograph, but the locals ignored her. Morrison put his hand on her arm. "Come on, love," he said. "Let's go home." She looked through him. He wondered what she was seeing. She said, "We are home. In this place, the walls of the world are thin. We can hear him calling to us through the walls. Listen, you can hear him. Listen." Dolores did not fight or even protest as they led her back to the hotel. Dolores did not look like a prophet. She looked like a woman in her late 30s wearing nothing but a sheet. Morrison suspected that their guide was amused, but when he caught her eyes, he could see only concern. They drove from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, and it was on the beach in front of their hotel, after sleeping for almost 24 hours, that Dolores came back, now just slightly confused, with little memory of the previous day. He tried to talk to her about what he had seen, about what she had said, but stopped when he saw it was upsetting her. They pretended that it had not happened, did not mention it again. Sometimes he wondered what it had felt like inside her head that day, hearing the voice of God through the golden-colored stones, but truly, he did not want to know. It was better not to. "It's location-specific. You take the person out of Jerusalem," he thought, wondering, as he had wondered 100 times in the last few days, if this was truly far enough. He was glad they were back in England, glad they were home where there was not enough time to crush you, to suffocate you, to make you dust. Morrison walked back up the avenue in the drizzle, past the trees in the pavement, past the neat front gardens and the summer flowers and the perfect green of the lawns, and he felt cold. He knew she would be gone before he turned the corner, before he saw the open front door banging in the wind. He would follow her, and, he thought, almost joyfully, he would find her. This time, he would listen. Click-clack, the rattleback. "Before you take me up to bed, will you tell me a story?" "Do you actually need me to take you up to bed?" I asked the boy. He thought for a moment, then, with intense seriousness, "Yes, actually, I think I do. It's because of I've finished my homework, and so it's my bedtime, and I am a bit scared. Not very scared, just a bit. But it is a very big house, and lots of times the lights don't work, and it's sort of dark." I reached over and tousled his hair. "I can understand that," I said. "It is a very big old house." He nodded. We were in the kitchen, where it was light and warm. I put down my magazine on the kitchen table. "What kind of story would you like me to tell you?" "Well," he said thoughtfully, "I don't think it should be too scary, because then when I go up to bed, I will just be thinking about monsters the whole time. But if it isn't just a little bit scary, then I won't be interested. And you make up scary stories, don't you? I know she says that's what you do." "Well, she exaggerates. I write stories, yes. Nothing that's really been published yet, though. And I write lots of different kinds of stories." "But you do write scary stories?" "Yes." The boy looked up at me from the shadows by the door, where he was waiting. "Do you know any stories about Click-Clack the Rattlebag?" "I don't think so." "Those are the best sorts of stories." "Do they tell them at your school?" He shrugged. "Sometimes." "What's a Click-Clack the Rattlebag story?" He He was a precocious child, and was unimpressed by his sister's boyfriend's ignorance. You could see it on his face. Everybody knows them. I don't, I said, trying not to smile. He looked at me as if he was trying to decide whether or not I was pulling his leg. He said, I think maybe you should take me up to my bedroom, and then you can tell me a story before I go to sleep. But probably it should be a not scary story because I'll be up in my bedroom then, and it's actually a bit dark up there too. I said, shall I leave a note for your sister, telling her where we are? You can, but you'll hear when they get back. The front door is very slammy. We walked out of the warm and cozy kitchen into the hallway of the big house, where it was chilly and drafty and dark. I flicked the light switch, but the hall remained dark. The bulb's gone, said the boy. That always happens. Our eyes adjusted to the shadows. The moon was almost full, and blue-white moonlight shone in through the high windows on the staircase down into the hall. We'll be all right, I said. Yes, said the boy soberly. I am very glad you're here. He seemed less precocious now. His hand found mine, and he held on to my fingers comfortably, trustingly, as if he'd known me all his life. I felt responsible and adult. I did not know if the feeling I had for his sister, who was my girlfriend, was love, not yet. But I liked that the child treated me as one of the family. I felt like his big brother, and I stood taller, and if there was something unsettling about the empty house, I would not have admitted it for worlds. The stairs creaked beneath the threadbare stair carpet. Click-clacks, said the boy, are the best monsters ever. Are they from television? I don't think so. I don't think any people know where they come from. Mostly, they come from the dark. Good place for a monster to come. Yes. We walked along the upper corridor, in the shadows, moving from patch of moonlight to patch of moonlight. It really was a big house. I wished I had a flashlight. They come from the dark, said the boy, holding on to my hand. I think probably they're made of dark, and they come in when you don't pay attention. That's when they come in, and then they take you back to their, oh, not nests. What's a word that's like nests, but not? House? No, it's not a house. Lair? He was silent. Then, I think that's the word, yes. Lair. He squeezed my hand. He stopped talking. Right. So they take the people who don't pay attention back to their lair. And what do they do then, your monsters? Do they suck all the blood out of you, like vampires? He snorted. Vampires don't suck all the blood out of you. They only drink a little bit, just to keep them going and, you know, flying around. Click-clacks are much scarier than vampires. I'm not scared of vampires, I told him. Me neither. I'm not scared of vampires either. Do you want to know what click-clacks do? They drink you, said the boy. Like a Coke. Coke is very bad for you, said the boy. If you put a tooth in Coke in the morning, it will be dissolved into nothing. That's how bad Coke is for you and why you must always clean your teeth every night. I'd heard the Coke story as a boy, and had been told as an adult that it wasn't true, but was certain that a lie which promoted dental hygiene was a good lie, and I let it pass. Click-clacks drink you, said the boy. First they bite you, and then you go all icky inside, and all your meat and all your brains and everything except your bones and your skin turns into a wet, milkshaky stuff, and then the click-clack sucks it out through the holes where your eyes used to be. That's disgusting, I told him. Did you make it up? We'd reached the last flight of stairs, all the way into the big house. No. I can't believe you kids make up stuff like that. You didn't ask me about the rattle bag, he said. Right. What's the rattle bag? Well, he said, sagely, soberly, a small voice from the darkness beside me.
Once you're just bones and skin, they hang you up on a hook, and you rattle in the wind.
So what do these click-clacks look like? Even as I asked him, I wished I could take the question back and leave it unasked. I thought, huge, spidery creatures like the one in the shower this morning. I'm afraid of spiders. I was relieved when the boy said, they look like what you aren't expecting, what you aren't paying attention to. We were climbing wooden steps now. I held on to the railing on my left, held his hand with my right as he walked beside me. It smelled like dust and old wood that high in the house. The boy's tread was certain, though, even though the moonlight was scarce.
Do you know what story you're going to tell me to put me to bed? He asked. Like I said, it doesn't actually have to be scary.
Not really.
Maybe you could tell me about this evening. Tell me what you did.
And that won't make much of a story for you. My girlfriend just moved into a new place on the edge of town. She inherited it from an aunt or someone. It's very big and very old. I'm going to spend my first night with her tonight, so I've been waiting for an hour or so for her and her housemates to come back with the wine and an Indian takeaway.
See? Said the boy.
There was that precocious amusement again. But all kids can be insufferable sometimes when they think they know something you don't. It's probably good for them.
You know all that, but you don't think. You just let your brain fill in the gaps.
He pushed open the door to the attic room. It was perfectly dark now, but the opening door disturbed the air, and I heard things rattle gently, like dry bones in thin bags in the slight wind. Click. Clack. Click. Clack. Like that. I would have pulled away then, if I could. But small, firm fingers pulled me forward, unrelentingly, into the dark. An Invocation of Incuriosity. There are flea markets all across Florida, and this was not the worst of them. It had once been an aircraft hangar, but the local airport had closed over 20 years before. There were 100 traders there, behind their metal tables, most of them selling counterfeit merchandise, sunglasses, or watches, or bags, or belts. There was an African family selling carved wooden animals, and behind them a loud, blousy woman named, I cannot forget the name, Charity Parrot, sold coverless paperback books and old pulp magazines, the paper browned and crumbling, and beside her, in the corner, a Mexican woman, whose name I never knew, sold film posters and curling film stills. I bought books from Charity Parrot, sometimes. Soon enough, the woman with the film posters went away, and was replaced by a small man in sunglasses, his grey tablecloth spread over the metal table and covered with small carvings. I stopped and examined them. A peculiar set of creatures made of grey bone and stone and dark wood. And then I examined him. I wondered if he had been in a ghastly accident, the kind it takes plastic surgery to repair. His face was wrong, the way it sloped, the shape of it. His skin was too pale. His too black hair looked like it had to be a wig made, perhaps, of dog fur. His glasses were so dark as to hide his eyes completely. He did not look in any way out of place in a Florida flea market. The tables were all manned by strange people, and strange people shopped there. I bought nothing from him. The next time I was there, Charity Parrot had in her turn moved on, her place taken by an Indian family who sold hookers and smoking paraphernalia. But the little man in the dark glasses was still in his corner at the back of the flea market with his grey cloth. On it were more carvings of creatures. I do not recognize any of these animals, I told him.
No.
Do you make them yourself? He shook his head. You cannot ask anyone in a flea market where they get their stuff from. There are few things that are taboo in a flea market, but that is. Sources are inviolate.
Do you sell a lot?
Enough to feed myself, he said. Keep a roof over my head. Then, they are worth more than I ask for them. I picked up something that reminded me a little of what a deer might look like if deer were carnivorous, and said, What is this?